From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the CIA in decline. We talk with journalist Mark Perry, author of a new book about the CIA. He says while the left worries the agency is too powerful and the right worries it's not powerful enough, the CIA is becoming the quintessential government bureaucracy, and it's missed some of the biggest stories. Also today, a talk with law professor Derek Bell about why he thinks racism is a permanent part of American life. Bell took a leave of absence from Harvard Law School, saying he wouldn't return until an African-American woman was given tenure. Bell was since dismissed. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews 1492. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush met today with Prime Minister Brian Mulroney of Canada and President Carlos Salinas of Mexico to initial the North American Free Trade Agreement. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
What would have normally been a perfunctory event was elevated to a major presidential ceremony today as the three leaders met in San Antonio to initial the treaty. All three claim it will create hundreds of thousands of new jobs in their countries. President Bush has made NAFTA a centerpiece of his re-election campaign, and today's event was an opportunity for him to look presidential and to show how his foreign policy prowess can result in economic benefits at home. The president chose his adopted home state of Texas for the event. Texas is a state that will benefit from increased trade with Mexico, and it's a state the president badly needs to win. A new Mason-Dixon poll today showed the president's lead only within the margin of error. The poll has Bush with 40%, Bill Clinton with 35%, and Texas businessman Ross Perot with 14% in Texas. In San Antonio, I'm Mara Liasson.
British Prime Minister John Major was roundly attacked by his former mentor today for his support of the Treaty on European Unity. Former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher wrote an article condemning the Maastricht Treaty and the European currency system as the visions of yesterday. Thatcher said the European exchange rate mechanism was inflexible and that Major should have removed the pound sterling from it sooner. It was Thatcher's government that made Britain a part of the system in the first place. The article was published just a day before the former Prime Minister, now known as Lady Thatcher, was scheduled to appear with Major at the Conservative Party's annual convention. The State Department questions the seriousness of Serbia's latest promise to halt military flights over Bosnia. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Serbian authorities said they'd stop the flights if opposing forces ended offensive action in the brutal fighting throughout Bosnia. But State Department spokesman Richard Boucher pointed out today that Serbia agreed to a ban on all military flights over Bosnia weeks ago at a conference in London, and they have not kept that commitment, he said. The State Department believes Serbia's latest no-fly offer is an effort to persuade the UN Security Council not to ban military flights. Boucher said the U.S. will continue to push for a U.N. resolution banning the flights. President Bush has said the U.S. military will help enforce the ban if asked. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Peruvian government said today that the leader of the Shining Path guerrilla movement has been convicted of treason and sentenced to life in prison. Abimael Guzman was tried in secret by a military tribunal because of government fears that the trial would be the target of revenge attacks by the guerrillas. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 26 points to close at 3,152. This is NPR. Analysts said today that it appears the Federal Reserve has decided against further cuts in interest rates and may not act again until after the presidential election. Many investors had been predicting that the central bank would cut the discount rate by another half point to 2.5%. Such a move was widely seen as a way to stimulate the economy in response to September's job losses. The Fed's Policymaking Open Market Committee met yesterday in Washington, but apparently decided not to cut rates. Scientists say they've discovered a new use for the controversial French abortion pill. A study in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine suggests the drug is an effective morning-after contraceptive. NPR's David Barron reports.
The drug RU486 is used by women in France and several other countries to induce abortion in early pregnancy. Now, researchers say the same pill can prevent pregnancy when used in the first few days after intercourse. Scientists in Scotland gave the drug to 400 women who'd had unprotected sex and found that none became pregnant. Lead researcher David Baird says, used this way, the French abortion pill could reduce abortions.
The more unwanted pregnancies you can prevent from establishing themselves, the less demand there'd be for abortion, the fewer abortions you do.
But anti-abortion activists say they oppose using RU486 in this way as well. Since the drug prevents a fertilized egg from implanting itself in the womb, they claim it's still a form of abortion. I'm David Barron in Boston.
A survey of police hiring practices in 50 U.S. cities says that New York is the worst in terms of hiring black officers, while the Los Angeles Police Department is among the best. The survey, released today, found that the percentage of black officers in the New York Police Department has not increased in 9 years. The police departments rated the best included San Francisco, Miami, and Los Angeles. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The CIA may not be as powerful and omniscient as you think it is. That's one of the conclusions Mark Perry reaches in his new book, Eclipse, which is about the decline of the CIA. Perry thinks the agency has been in decline since the beginning of the end of the Cold War. His book covers the year from the death of Director William Casey in 1987 to the swearing-in of Robert Gates in 1991. Perry is also the author of Four Stars, The Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the American Military. I asked Perry why he thinks the CIA is in decline.
Well, I think it's been in decline for a number of years for a number of reasons, the most prominent being that the target has disappeared. The Soviet Union is no longer the great empire that it was. It's no longer the threat that it was. 50% of the CIA's budget was given over to trying to understand the Soviet Union, trying to be able to predict its moves and counter its moves, and the target simply isn't there anymore. So 50% of all the employees at the CIA, 50% of their budget is now going for a purpose that no longer exists. That's the primary reason.
But there's other reasons, too, you have in mind.
There are other reasons. I think that the CIA long ago had its day. The rise of technological collection means, satellites, intercepts, that type of thing. Certainly dampened the need to have human intelligence sources, which used to be the CIA's stock and trade. Also, I think over the last decade or so, especially during the Reagan and Bush years, the CIA has become more and more politicized as an institution, has served the president more and more instead of the country, and so was always looking over its shoulder to find out or to try to be able to predict what the president wanted. So it's, as I say in the book, it's an agency in eclipse that has to reformulate and rethink its goals.
You focus in the book largely from Casey to Gates. Why have you focused on that period? You call that the most revolutionary transformation of American intelligence in U.S. history, that period.
Well, I think it is revolutionary primarily because, as I pointed out, the disappearance of the target. But also in that period, we had a very conservative administration. An administration that was thought to have used the CIA for its own ends. I remember when Bush became president, all the journalists were talking about, oh, this man is the CIA president. Well, I thought it would be important to focus on a man who'd been CIA director and president at the same time. It's unique in our history. It's the first time it's ever happened.
Yet you say that President Bush has relied less on the CIA than any other president.
It's kind of a paradox. Bush, we were all looking over our shoulders to see how Bush would use the CIA, and while we were always trying to measure the pulse of the CIA, Bush actually styled himself the ultimate CIA officer, a very good intelligence officer. This, though, he only had 9 months on the job at the CIA itself. As it turns out, Bush is the ultimate paradox simply because, as a CIA officer, he's the one president in our history that really hasn't listened to the CIA at all. He isn't the quintessential CIA insider, the secret link to our covert or dark side in this country. Not at all. In fact, when the CIA has come to him on a number of occasions with startling new information, he's ignored it.
But you say he relied more on personal diplomacy. He relied more on what his own aides were telling him.
Well, this is the stock and trade of the intelligence officer, or people who style themselves the intelligence officer. They always want to believe their own sources. When the CIA, I'll give you a good for instance, when the CIA came to George Bush in August of 1990 and said, Iraq is going to invade Kuwait. He told the director of Central Intelligence, I just don't believe that. My sources, he said, tell me that that's not going to happen. Well, the obvious question is, who are his sources? Well, his sources were Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, president of Egypt, and King Hussein of Jordan. So he acted as his own intelligence officer, and he missed the boat. He failed to listen to the CIA when it would have been a good idea for him to do so.
In terms of Bush's own tenure as the head of the CIA, you say if he hadn't become president, he would have been the most forgettable head of the CIA in CIA history.
Well, it's very true. I mean, he only served for 9 months. That's a perfect example of what at the agency is called an interim director. He didn't really have much of an impact. And even in areas where he did have an impact, in assessing the Soviet analysis, for instance, accounting of missiles and who was right and who was wrong, Bush always came down on the politically safe side of an issue. He waltzed through his CIA career. It was just for him, I think, another line on his resume.
There's an ongoing debate within the CIA that you write a lot about between the people who believe that the CIA should be an objective source of intelligence information and a more activist source of information. Would you outline that difference for us?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, we have to understand the CIA in a way that we haven't thought about it before. The CIA is in many ways a perfect mirror of our own society during the Cold War, from left-wing liberals to straighter-than-arrow moderates to very right-wing conservatives. There are those kinds of people and have been those kinds of people at the CIA for 40 years. Now, given that political understanding and the 40 years of history we've been through during the Cold War, it's easy to imagine that there also might be liberals and conservatives at the CIA, and in fact, there were. There was a group of analysts who believed that the Soviet Union in the 1970s was on its last legs and was losing its empire, and they predicted the deterioration of the Soviet empire. There were conservatives who just didn't believe that. Their experience taught them they said something else. So these two groups clashed for almost two decades inside the CIA, until that fight finally became public in the confirmation of Robert Gates.
Where does Gates fit in?
Gates is a very conservative, straight arrow, intransigent, I think, cold warrior. While he's very politically astute, and he's followed all the right moves to make it as a director of Central Intelligence, he's always been of the mind that the Soviet Union was an empire bent on world domination, that it would take advantage of American weakness wherever it could. And he opposed the liberals inside the CIA and for two decades undermined them.
When the confirmation hearings for Gates were underway, he was accused of cooking information so that it conformed with what the Reagan administration wanted to hear or what the Bush administration wanted to hear. Is that related to the whole, you know, objective versus activist agenda that you're talking about?
Yes, it is. I think that if you take a look very clearly at a lot of the national intelligence estimates that were made by the CIA in the 1980s, you will find that they're very, very conservative. The Soviet Union is involved in international terrorism. The Soviet Union is behind the assassination plot on the Pope. All of these conservative agendas, conservative national intelligence estimates, you will find the hand of Robert Gates, a man who knew that in order to please the Reagan administration and, in fact, the director of Central Intelligence, he had to, let us say, skew the documents, skew the national intelligence estimates to give a more hardline view of the Soviet Union, or so his detractors say. Gates falls back on the defense that he was just trying to make intelligence documents and intelligence estimates more precise, more well-written, and more reflective of the reality in the Cold War years. Clearly, during his confirmation hearings, many top analysts at the CIA, many operations officers, came down on the other side of Gates and said he had really been tampering with intelligence.
Have you uncovered any evidence that indicates that President Reagan or President Bush really wanted their intelligence information cooked to conform to their worldview?
I have not come across evidence of that. What I've come across is really, I think, much more fatal to how we look at the CIA. Reagan and Bush clearly didn't want to hear that the Soviet Union was changing and that there was a new wave of reform. But even if the CIA had said that, and they did say that, they would have been ignored in the White House. The fact of the matter is that the CIA and CIA estimates carried no great weight in government during the Reagan and Bush years. The CIA may have been relied on for other operations, but its analysis of world events was just simply ignored. The Reagan administration and the Bush administration have followed their own course on foreign policy, regardless of the facts.
So you think the CIA was relied on more for covert activist operations than for objective analysis?
Yes, I do. I think that we had a very activist director in William Casey. He had his own agenda. He was a very prominent figure in the Reagan administration. I think that the Reagan administration started to rely on the CIA to do things privately, what could not be done publicly.
Examples?
Well, I think supplying the Contras when it was clearly not in the spirit of the congressional law to supply the Contras was a prime example of that. I think that the Iran operation, which was really a White House operation, which was shifted to the CIA, was another example of that. These were policies that could not be followed publicly, that the Reagan administration chose to handle privately, and the CIA was there to handle them.
Were there specific incidents you learned about in the conflicts between Presidents Reagan and Bush and the CIA in dealing with the end of the Cold War? You know, if as you say, the CIA was predicting that this was very possible and the Bush and Reagan administrations were resisting it.
Well, I think the two examples that I mentioned are the clearest. But the overriding sense that you get from reading national intelligence estimates during this period is the feeling that the CIA is somehow tilting its belief about the Soviet Union's capacity to compete with the United States economically. The CIA continued to pour out these estimates that said that the Soviet Union wasn't on its last legs economically. There's one study that I recall reading that said that East Germany would catch up to West Germany economically in 1978, is the year they mentioned. You could have asked a cab driver in East Berlin whether that was true, and he would have told you it's absolutely ridiculous. But the CIA continued to push this position that somehow the Soviet Union was an economically viable entity. And as we learned in 1989, that was the furthest thing from the truth. So the biggest story of the Cold War, the things that we spent billions of dollars on, gave to the CIA, the hundreds of economic analysts and military intelligence officers that we hired to tell us the big story, whether the Soviet Union was going to attack us, how they were waging a war against us, how they were going to compete with us. That story, the CIA completely missed. And they didn't miss it by a little bit. They missed it by a mile.
I'm sorry, let me just stop because I'm a little confused. I thought you were saying that the CIA was kind of predicting the head of the Soviet Union and Bush and Reagan weren't listening.
Only one small group in the Soviet analysis division was predicting that, the people surrounding Mel Goodman. Mel Goodman, Jennifer Glaudemans, these people within the Soviet analytic division were the ones that were predicting that things were changing in the Soviet Union. They were pointing out the debates that were actually going on inside the Politburo for example, whether to invade Afghanistan. But their dissent was really muffled over the years, and that made all the difference.
So not only didn't the presidents listen to them, the CIA didn't listen either.
That's right. There was a tendency inside the Reagan administration to speak with one voice, and you always hear this from CIA officers. They say it's important for the CIA to speak with one voice. Well, that voice during the Cold War and during the Reagan years was the voice of the Cold War, and all dissent to the contrary was really muffled.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the subject of your new book, Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA. My guest is journalist Mark Perry. This is Fresh Air. Mark Perry is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA. In your book, you write that the left sees the CIA as a government within the government. The right sees the CIA as having been compromised. And you say the truth is really more disturbing. The truth is that the CIA has become a big bureaucracy.
Yes, it has. As you might expect, over 40 years, the CIA has lost its edge quite a bit. This is like any other government bureaucracy, and we have to understand it that way. We're used to John Le Carré novels and Ian Fleming novels, but this is a bureaucracy. It's filled with analysts and economists and political analysts, and covert operations is really a small part of the CIA, a significant part, but a small part of the CIA.
So what's the problem with the CIA having become a bureaucracy?
The problem is that, well, when I started this book, I began with the assumption that we needed an intelligence bureaucracy. I still believe that, but we don't need this one. I think that the CIA is too tied to the White House, too tied to the presidents. They're there, as they say, to follow the president's orders, to do his bidding. We need an intelligence arm of this government that is far more objective and willing to take chances than the CIA is right now. We need a streamlined bureaucracy, one that is fully accountable to the Congress, and that in itself will not threaten the so-called sources and methods that the CIA is always touting. This is not the intelligence agency that we need at all, and it's not doing the job for us.
Are you skeptical that it will be reformed under Robert Gates?
Yes, I am. I don't think that there's any chance that the CIA can be reformed under Robert Gates. Frankly, Robert Gates' nomination was widely opposed, deeply opposed in some offices of the CIA. He's not trusted by some people, especially in the Operations Directorate. And in order to affect the kind of reforms that the CIA needs and that we need as a country, Robert Gates is not the man to be there. Whoever becomes the next president certainly has to take note of that and has to act accordingly. There's a big reorganization plan on the Hill. It is going to be enacted in some form over the next 2 years. The president is going to have to decide what kind of an intelligence agency this country needs.
Is the CIA moving toward economic intelligence, counterterrorism, narcotics, the areas that you hear mentioned in a post-Cold War CIA?
They are, but slowly, and more work needs to be done, especially in narcotics and economics. Now, I heard Robert Gates several months ago saying the CIA is not going to collect economic intelligence. I can't think of anything more foolish. We need a very good organization, institute, to study how our competitors in the world markets are competing with us, what new technologies they're getting, how we can compete against them. Economic intelligence is always thought of as hooliganism or a delinquency of some kind where you throw a wrench in somebody else's machine. This is information gathering. It's important that we find out how many bushels of rice Japan is planning to export over the next year. It's very important for us. And this kind of work isn't being done by the CIA. It should be done by the CIA.
Did you get access to any classified materials that made you see a story in a different way than you had before?
Yes, when I began to write Eclipse, I was able to obtain classified documents from an executive department source on some of the key operations that CIA was involved in around the world. Parts of these documents appear in the book. I think that what the document showed me is that the really big secrets that everyone worries about, the smoking gun that all investigative journalists worry about, is really not there. What government officials worry about more than anything is not that some of their sources will be blown, but that they'll be embarrassed. And you see this again and again and again in the documents, which are highly classified, discussions between government officials on how to handle testimony, descriptions of senators and congressmen they don't like. These things are embarrassing, and they don't want them publicized, and so they're classified top secret. I was amazed at the amount of information I was able to gather, and I was also amazed at how sensitive the government is to these kinds of leaks.
Your book Eclipse is subtitled The Last Days of the CIA. Now, how literally do you mean that? Do you think that the CIA is not only in decline, but it's going to end soon?
I think if I were a historian 100 years from now and looking back, doing a study of the CIA, I would pinpoint the rise of Gorbachev as being the point where the CIA started to fall apart. I mean it really, not literally, but figuratively. The CIA may go on and on and on and on for the next 40 years, for all I know. But the worst thing that can happen to a government bureaucracy in Washington is happening to the CIA, and that is that it's being ignored.
Let me ask you, you know, so many Americans have this point of view that the CIA is so powerful and so influential and so often leading the charge in covert foreign policy. And now you're saying, well, the real truth is that the CIA is being ignored. It's really hard to reconcile these two incredibly and wildly different points of view.
Yes. Well, that's the point of the book. That's the real point of the book. I really believe that we have been the subjects of a great deal of mythology about the CIA. Now we have the CIA involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The fact of the matter is that the CIA, like every other government bureaucracy, has its successes and failures, its good professionals and bad professionals. I think that they're vastly overrated, vastly overrated. There are actually journalists in Washington who run around worrying that the CIA is tapping their phones. The CIA is just, they're not interested in that. They're just not interested in that. And I think we've really blown out of proportion the effectiveness of this agency. We've become believers in their own mythology. They'd like us to believe that they're really effective. They'd love us to believe that they're in every alley in every third world country in the world. I wish they were. They might do a better job, but the fact of the matter is that they're not.
Are you surprised to hear yourself saying this?
Yeah, very surprised. I'm very surprised. I thought that this was a much more romantic agency than it turned out to be. That it was involved in super secrets that no one could ever talk about. Fact of the matter is that sooner or later everyone hears about a covert operation. You can't keep a secret too long at the CIA, and journalists find out about them all the time, or they're leaked. And I think it's time that we shuck the mythology of the CIA, that we look at it with very, very clear eyes. The Cold War is over. The target is gone. We have a big job ahead of us. We have to have an intelligence organization that can do that job.
Mark Perry is the author of Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Derrick Bell was the first tenured African-American in the Harvard Law School. He took a leave of absence 2 years ago, saying he wouldn't return until a black woman was given tenure. He was recently dismissed. Coming up, we talk with Bell about his new book on the permanence of racism in America. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews 1492, the new movie about Columbus starring Gerard Depardieu and Sigourney Weaver. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In advance of this Sunday's first presidential debate, President Bush was in Texas today for the initialing of a North America Free Trade Agreement. The agreement must still be signed by Mr. Bush, but this cannot happen until at least December. And then Congress has to approve implementing measures. Chief of Staff James Baker was also at the meeting with Canada and Mexico in his first out-of-town trip with the president since Baker left the State Department in August. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton was back home in Little Rock before heading to St. Louis in preparations for the upcoming debate. Independent presidential candidate Ross Perot has now been invited by the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates to take part in all three meetings. Six crew members on board an Air National Guard transport plane were killed today in a crash near Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. Cecilia Mason of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
The C-130E aircraft went down around 9:30 this morning in a neighborhood just northeast of Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, crashing into a house. The man inside the house escaped without receiving any major injuries. Betty Niederkoffler lives near the crash and saw the plane go down.
Just all flames. You couldn't tell it was a plane. Well, you knew it was a plane, but you couldn't see a plane at all. It was totally engulfed in flames and just crossed the road and exploded.
The plane was from the West Virginia Air National Guard base about 30 miles away in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Base spokesman Major Pat Dockney says the plane was on a routine training mission. He says an Air Force investigation team will look into the cause of the crash. For National Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia.
In Anderson, Indiana, the United Auto Workers Union is threatening a strike at a General Motors plant. Dan Dreyer of member station WBNI reports.
The International UAW has given the Inland Fisher Guide plant in Anderson, Indiana, its 5-day strike notice. David Toombs, a spokesman for UAW Local 663, says the letter authorizes the union to strike if agreement is not reached within 5 business days. Industry leaders say a strike in Anderson could devastate General Motors production system-wide. The plant supplies 95% of all exterior lighting, except headlamps, to car and truck assembly plants. Local 663 represents 3,400 workers. Union leaders say the main issue involves contracting work outside the United States. The International Union has already struck twice this year at plants in Lansing, Michigan, and Lordstown, Ohio. For National Public Radio, I'm Dan Dreher reporting.
For the second time in 24 hours, an explosion has occurred in central London. 5 people were injured in the earlier blast. No casualties have been reported in the second. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 26 points to close at 3,152.25. This is NPR News. According to Moscow News reports, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has taken away former Soviet leader Gorbachev's extensive research center property. This came after Gorbachev accused Yeltsin of being unable to handle his job as president. The order also came after Gorbachev continued to refuse to testify in a trial involving the banning of the Communist Party. After Gorbachev criticized Yeltsin's economic changes earlier this year, he lost his official limousine. The Russian government has issued its first ever assessment of the state of health and the environment, and it finds that Russia is facing an environmental disaster of unprecedented proportion. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Under the former Soviet government, information on environmental damage was kept secret. Now the Russian government, in an effort to confront its environmental and health problems openly, has issued a report that paints a devastating picture of health in Russia. According to this report, half of the tap water in the country is unfit to drink. Only a quarter of the nation's children are healthy when they leave school. Only one-fifth of young men are fit for military duty, applying international health standards. The report also admits that 2.5 million Russians live in the area contaminated by the Chernobyl nuclear power plant explosion, and 1.5 million live in areas contaminated by nuclear weapons testing. The report says pollution levels of Russia's vast river system exceeds international norms by dozens or even hundreds of times. As for air quality, more than a third of all Russians live in cities where the air pollution exceeds acceptable levels by 10 times or more. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Airplanes from Turkey have once again bombed Kurdish bases in northern Iraq. Earlier this year, Turkish military jets made similar airstrikes. In recent weeks, rebel forces have stepped up their attacks, and last week, Iraqi Kurds started a military drive against rebel groups in Turkey. Turkish rebels have imposed an economic blockade on northern Iraq. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Derrick Bell became the first African-American faculty member of the Harvard Law School in 1969. In 1990, he took an unpaid leave of absence, saying he wouldn't return until the law school hired and gave tenure to a woman of color. He was dismissed when his protest extended beyond 2 years, the maximum leave that Harvard grants. He's now a visiting professor at NYU Law School. Although Bell is a civil rights lawyer and has worked with the NAACP, he is pessimistic about the court's ability to enforce racial equality. In fact, he's pessimistic that blacks will ever have equality in the United States. He explains why in his new book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism. The book is a series of parables about racial attitudes. In his story, Space Traders, beings from another planet come to Earth and offer to solve all of America's problems if the aliens can take all the African Americans back to their mother star.
I was trying to look at a situation somewhat in the future, in the year 2000, in which the United States would have an opportunity to correct, in effect, all of its mistakes of the last several generations by one trade. And, of course, there's a lot of debate, and I try to take it day by day. The space traders arrive on New Year's Day in the year 2000, and they indicate that they will give the country 2 weeks and will then await their decision. And each day I look at the various aspects of the society and how they might debate it, what positions they might take.
Yeah, well, you have different groups being willing to make different compromises.
That's right.
What are some of those compromises?
Well, I have a conservative president and his cabinet quite ready to accept a trade because it's going to be an election year, and this certainly gets them out of serious difficulties. Of course, I have the civil rights groups all gathered together, ready to file suits and protest and do all of the usual, usually unproductive things that civil rights groups do. I have the far-right TV evangelists favoring the trade because it's God's will. And I have the corporate leaders opposing the trade because it's going to take away valuable markets. And the liberals do what the liberals are usually expected to do, and conservatives follow form as well. And finally, there is a constitutional amendment to deal with the legal issues that is submitted to a popular referendum. It's kind of a loaded deck because civil rights measures always go down to defeat in popular referenda. In any event, the referendum here comes out 70-30 for the trade. And the interesting thing about it is that I ask my audiences usually, if this happened, how would the country vote? And blacks in the audience, almost to a person, are quite certain that the vote would be for the trade. Whites are more ambivalent, but when I ask them to consider very seriously how their home community or the community they know best would vote, their hands slowly, that were clenched in their laps, slowly come up, almost painfully come up into the air, and most believe that their communities would vote for the trade. And that's the point I wanted to make.
So you believe people would vote for a trade?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
You think that African Americans are worse off now than at any time since slavery, and that the advances of the 60s and 70s have been reversed. What makes you say that?
I certainly get a lot of resistance when I say that, because they point to all of the success stories, including my own, and say, well, how can you say that? You couldn't have been where you are 30, 40 years ago. And that's right. But that simply masked the real condition of most of Black America, certainly the third or so at the bottom. I can't imagine how their condition could be worse, save in slavery. And even in slavery, as some of the comedians, Dick Gregory and others, have pointed out, slavery at least was a full employment law. And Blacks have not had a full employment law since then. And as a matter of fact, systematic policies and efforts have resulted in being denied employment.
You're just joining us. My guest is Derek Bell, and he has a new book called Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism. Yeah, you left Harvard on a leave without pay, saying that you wouldn't return until an African-American woman was given tenure at the law school. And after 2 years of your leave without pay, you were dismissed by Harvard because their policy is of a maximum two-year leave.
Right.
Let me ask you, since you think it's very important that African-American women students have African-American women teachers, as an African-American male professor, what do you feel that you offer your African-American students that your white counterpart couldn't provide?
Yeah. I guess one, I teach teach constitutional law, of course, on the Supreme Court and one on civil rights. But in all my courses, I really have to teach the basic messages of my life. And that is that the rewards, the satisfactions, are not in being partner or making $1 million, but in recognizing evils, recognizing injustices, and standing up and speaking out about them, even in absolutely losing situations where you know it's not going to bring about any change, that there are intangible rewards to the spirit that make that worthwhile. And while I certainly miss my position at Harvard, I worked very hard for it, and people tell me I should have stayed and worked from within, in some ways I am grateful for the opportunity to, in so public a way, practice what I've preached for so long. Because if only a few students get that message, then those few students, to the extent that they are able to practice it in their own lives, will receive the kind of spiritual, soul-satisfying dividends that I think I've received, and make me believe that that's really an important thing of what life is all about.
Well, you could make the argument that your method of dealing with this by taking the leave was actually a self-defeating way of handling it, because now the students don't have you there either.
That's right, but there are five other Black men, all very capable. And I think that some of them will be more willing to step into the role that I was playing now that I'm not there, that my presence tended to perhaps stifle some of their development as leaders. I learned this hard lesson as a civil rights lawyer when, during the 60s, I would fly into town and meet with several groups and take down all the information about their problems and the discrimination here in the schools or in the public accommodations, and would fly back to New York and prepare the complaints and get them filed and handle the cases. And I thought that, I tell you, I thought that my place in heaven was assured. But looking back on it, I see that I, by my flying in all, and was really usurping the leadership potential of many local people who, even after I won the case, if they didn't organize and inform the their constituencies of what had been done through the courts, nothing would change. So that I am a much more humble with regard to my role today than I was as a young civil rights lawyer.
Harvard Law School wasn't the first place that you quit in protest. In 1959, you were working in the Justice Department, and you were told to drop your membership in the NAACP.
Because it was a conflict of interest. I was in the new Civil Rights Division. And that seemed strange to me. And I checked with a number of friends in important places. And almost to a person, they told me to stay and work from within. And I've always been a little suspect of that argument. It's very comfortable and convenient, but I'm not sure that it's necessarily accurate. In any event, I decided that I would not resign my membership, and I would wait for them to fire me, which they didn't. They simply moved me out of my office into the hall and started giving me kind of busy work, which was a message that maybe I should leave, and that's what I did. But in that instance, as in so many others, I went back to my hometown, Pittsburgh, and began working as the executive director of the NAACP. And I learned long years later that one of the people I'd gone to for advice, Bill Hasty, who was the first black federal judge, had gone to Thurgood Marshall, his longtime friend, and told him about my situation. So that when Thurgood came through Pittsburgh speaking, he was then general counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, he said, "Boy, what's a lawyer doing in a non-lawyer job?" And I tried to explain. He wasn't even listening. He said, "Oh, come on, join me in New York," which I did post-haste. Well, that was a marvelous experience, working with the Legal Defense Fund in the early 60s. And it's an experience I wouldn't have gotten had I not done what I thought was right with regard to my NAACP membership with the Justice Department.
My guest is law professor Derek Bell. He's the author of the new book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Derek Bell, your book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, is subtitled The Permanence of Racism. How convinced are you that racism is a permanent part of life in the United States?
Well, I keep hoping that someone in the back of an audience will raise their hand and be recognized and get up and demolish my thesis in a way that I have to confess and surrender and what have you. I keep hoping that will happen. I rather know it won't. It's a conclusion I reach very, very reluctantly. I see the potential for despair in it as well as any of my critics. And yet, I got to tell the truth. And my experience and my study of the whole history of this society indicates that unless changes can take place that I can't imagine are going to take place, then that racism is permanent.
What makes you say that racism is permanent?
Because from the very beginning, when slavery, no one ever asked, everybody admits that slavery was horrible, but no one ever asked, why did the poor whites who didn't own slaves, why did they allow that to happen? Because once the slave owners were allowed to establish a system of slavery, then that meant the poor whites were always going to be yeomen, always going to be living rather oppressive lives themselves. They were never going to be able to own slaves or compete with those who did. And yet they did buy into this on the basis of the arguments made, and Edmund Morgan points them out very well in his book, American Slavery, American Freedom, the contradiction of that, by promising the yeomen, the free whites, former indentured servants, that they could be part of the political system too, and they could vote because they were going to lower the poll taxes. But they had to stand together against the ever-present danger of slave revolts, you see. And it worked. So when a slave escaped, it was the poor whites that went rushing off into the marshes to haul him back, you see. And I look back at use the slavery example because it's so stark, it's far enough away so that we can understand it. But those things continue to happen to today. You see, look at George Bush and the Willie Horton situation. That really is the same form. It's saying they're dangerous down there, and we have to stand together. You see, the family values. Maybe I'm getting a little racially paranoid, but it seems to me a facet of the family values. It's that same kind of code wording that says we have to stand together against those people who are having all these babies out of wedlock, who are standing out on the corners instead of getting jobs, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I'm wondering, when you decided to take that unpaid leave of absence from Harvard until they hired an African-American woman professor, tenured Did you think that that would happen and that you'd end up back at Harvard, or did you figure that you were saying goodbye to Harvard Law School?
I thought it was a risk, but there were a couple of possibilities. One, that I knew that there were a number of faculty members who agreed with me, who agreed that one of two women who were there, black women who were there as visitors, really deserved to be there on a permanent basis. And if I thought that rather than simply urge them as I had been doing and sending memos around to all the faculty, that if I took this position, which is probably without very much precedent at Harvard Law School, that they would see, well, Derrick Bell is really serious, and we are his colleagues, and therefore we must stand with him in if not taking leave, at least going to the powers that be and demanding that something be done. That didn't happen. I also basically was supporting the students because they had been pushing on this and doing everything, including taking over the dean's office for a couple of years. And I thought there was a chance that they might come up with a new form of protest that would be more effective at getting at pressing their demands. That didn't happen.
We have time for one more question, and I'd like to use that time to find out why you decided to become a lawyer.
It's interesting. When I was a child, I built model airplanes, and I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. But I had no models of blacks as aeronautical engineers or even whites as aeronautical engineers. Plus, my math skills were deficient. But I did, on my paper route, have two lawyers. One was the only black judge in the area, and one was a practicing lawyer. And both of them and their wives were very supportive. They would always invite me in and ask me how I'm doing and give me a cookie or a cup of tea. And I was very impressed. And I thought that I could see my way from where I was to where they were. And I think that that has informed much of my effort, particularly at Harvard. It's very difficult to convince those who are at the top of the society how important models are for those who are much closer to the bottom.
Derrick Bell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Derrick Bell's new book is Faces at the Bottom of the Well. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tom Jelton reports on a Serbian military victory in northern Bosnia. Mara Lyson has a story about the women and men who are advising Governor Bill Clinton in his campaign. Many of them go way back with Bill Clinton to his days at Oxford in England. Also, we'll talk with a card naming expert in San Francisco about the complex and often arcane business of coming up with names for new cars, like Acura and Achieva and Geo. It turns out one of the best all-time car namers was the poet Marianne Moore.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Christopher Columbus, the movie, has already flopped, even with Marlon Brando in it. But just in time for Columbus Day, Paramount is releasing 1492, Conquest of Paradise, starring Gerard Depardieu as the legendary navigator, and directed by Ridley Scott, who made Alien, Blade Runner, and Thelma and Louise. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Ridley Scott makes pretty movies, but not always good ones. If you give him a screenwriter as talented as Callie Curry, he can turn out a film as terrific as Thelma and Louise. But as ravishing as the images in 1492 often are, I'm afraid the movie itself is stupefying. The screenwriter is a French journalist named Rosaline Bosch, and her dialogue not only sounds as though it were written in the midst of her Berlitz finals, it also sounds as though she hadn't seen a movie since the 40s. The style is stiff and stentorian. 1492 takes the historical pageant approach to the discovery of the Americas, with Gerard Depardieu, his streaming hair backlit just so, announcing that the world is round, and then hundreds of epicene Spanish courtiers growling things like, "Just what makes you think so, Señor Columbus?" Depardieu's heavy French accent might be justified on the grounds that Columbus was Italian, a foreigner in the Castilian court. But then, what are we to make of Armand Asante, who plays the royal Castilian treasurer Sanchez with a New York Puerto Rican accent? And Sigourney Weaver, who plays Queen Isabel as though she were the most marriageable debutante in Detroit. Trying to humanize the pageantry, the filmmakers have given Columbus a mistress, played by Angela Molina, who spends most of the movie beaming dumbly at Columbus and showering him with kisses before he leaves her again for another 4 years or so. Then there's the great man's relationship with Queen Isabel, which is a series of only-in-the-movies-style flirtations like this one.
Why should I believe in you, Señor Columbus?
Yes, I do. May I speak freely?
You show no inclination to speak otherwise.
I know what I see. I see someone who doesn't accept the world as it is, who's not afraid. I see a woman who thinks, what if?
A woman?
Forgive me. But you're the only queen I know.
Then that makes us equal. You are the only navigator that I know.
Once Columbus gets to the New World, the movie pulls out all the visual stops. Scott bathes the jungles of Hispaniola in cool white and hot yellow light. Emerald snakes bask on branches. Enormous birds flap slowly skyward. And the Holy Moly music by Vangelis makes you feel as though you've indeed entered paradise. But then the movie descends into the murk of history. Although Columbus was not the worst of the Spanish explorers, he was still far from enlightened, and 1492 gingerly shows him putting Indians to work mining gold without quite admitting that he was enslaving them. Instead of ignoring Spanish brutality altogether, the movie divides the Spanish into good guys and bad guys. Columbus, see, was a man of peace, but he was surrounded by scoundrels thirsting for Indian blood. Moreover, the scoundrels are noblemen who despise Columbus because of his lowly birth. That way we can root for our hero without feeling too politically incorrect. My bet, though, is that you won't wind up rooting for anybody. Gerard Depardieu brings his usual physical bravado to the role, but this must be one of the vaguest and least felt performances of his career, which isn't surprising. 1492 pretends that it wants to bring us an intimate, more human picture of its hero. Instead, it makes Columbus the Man feel oceans away.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the author of The Female Eunuch reaches menopause. We talk with Germaine Greer about her new book, The Change, Women, Aging, and the Menopause. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.